Have you ever been to a wedding and done something embarrassing? Have you ever done that? As you can imagine, I've been to a lot of weddings, and I have done a number of embarrassing things at different times at wedding. One was this last summer. I have a friend, Greg, and he was getting married at a very nice place, Deep Cove Chalet, out in the peninsula. And it was a beautiful day, and we were doing the wedding, and I was performing the wedding. It was a wonderful occasion. And Greg had told me beforehand that he had these custom-made wedding rings shipped in from Ireland. These were special rings. And so when I am performing a wedding, I have my Bible, and I have the ceremony. And then when it's time to do the rings, I turn to the best man, and he puts the ring on the Bible, and I come over and I give it to the groom, and the groom puts it on the bride's finger, and then I do the opposite. But here's what happened. I'm at Greg's wedding, and it's the ring time, and I turn to the groom to get the bride's custom-made ring, and the groom, no fault to him, he didn't put it flat, he put it edge up. And as I moved, it rolled off my Bible, and you hear this ding on the pavement, and then it goes into a bush. And I'm standing there shocked, thinking, oh no, now what? I can feel myself starting to turn red. I look at Greg. Let's just say he wasn't impressed. I looked at the bride. She was less impressed. I thought, what am I going to do? Am I going to go dig in this bush? And fortunately, the best man had seen it roll into the bush, and he got down on his knees, dug it out, and gave it back to me. I was restored. But it was embarrassing. Today, what we're going to do is we're going to look, as we continue our series, Everyday People, at a groom who experienced huge embarrassment at his own wedding reception. And to set us up today, Bowen is going to read the Bible story for us.
Jesus changes water to wine. John 2:1-11. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana, Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Dear woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied, "My time has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood 6 stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons of water. Then Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had a lot too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now." This, the first of his miraculous signs, Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him.
Thanks, Bowen. You did a great job. The invitations had gone out. The big day had come. The guests had arrived, including Jesus, his mother, and his disciples. And they'd all come to the village of Cana in the hills of Galilee to celebrate a wedding. Now, a little bit about marriage back then. Marriage in Jesus' day began with betrothal, which was a year-long engagement. It was way more binding than our engagements here in the West. A betrothal could only be broken by a divorce. And then after a year of engagement, the big day came. It was the day for the wedding. The groom and his friends would go over to the bride's house and escort the bride in a very festive way over to the groom's home. There was an exchange of rings, and the groom would give his bride gifts, and then the party would begin. The festivities went on for days, sometimes even for a week or more. Now, not only was the groom the featured person of the wedding, But the groom and his family had to pay for the whole affair. They had to supply absolutely everything. Now, with that background, let's go back to the story. The wedding celebration was in full swing, but as you heard when Bowen read the story, the wine ran out. Have you ever been to a wedding where something runs out? I've been to some weddings, often when they do the buffet and some of the food runs out, and it is horrifying for the host families. They're very embarrassed that the food has run out. Well, in Jesus' day, running out of wine was more than just an embarrassment. This was a culture of honor and shame. And basically, in an honor and shame culture, you receive honor and respect when you fulfill a group or a community's expectations. And you receive shame when you fail to meet a group or a community's expectations. Failing to meet expectations will cause the community to humiliate you, shun you, shame you. Thus, in a shame-honor culture, relationships and social standing are very important. In these cultures, in fact, your most valuable assets are your relationships, your reputation, your social standing in the community. And so every day you're trying to avoid shame and acquire honor. Again, when you fulfill the community's expectations, you receive honor. When you fail to fulfill the community's expectations, you receive shame. Do you see how running out of wine would bring shame to the groom and to his family? The guests were there. They're enjoying the party. They're expecting another glass of wine. And yet, their expectations were not going to be met. This was a social catastrophe. The groom and his family would face certain public shame and scorn if they couldn't fix the problem. And so in verse 3, Mary, that's Jesus' mother, turned to Jesus and said, "They have no more wine." She expected him to do something about it. But look how Jesus responded in verse 4. "Woman, why do you involve me? My hour has not yet come." Woman, Jesus, this is your mother. When our boys were growing up, we have two boys, when they were growing up, one of them would occasionally say to their mother, "Sylvia," at which point Sylvia would look at whichever boy had said that in the eyes and say, "There are only two boys in the entire world that get to call me mother." Mary needed to have that conversation with Jesus. You'd expect Jesus to address, of all people, you would expect Jesus to address his mother as mother. But he didn't. He called her woman. And in fact, he used that same expression at the cross when he asked John to take care of his mother. Now, I have no idea why Jesus did this. I have no idea. The best I can come up with is perhaps he was trying to separate family responsibilities from ministry responsibilities, but I have no idea. But what he says is, "Woman, why do you involve me?" In other words, this is not my problem. Mary didn't understand that Jesus' hour or time had not yet come. Jesus knew that his mother wanted him to act in a supernatural way to solve this problem, but if he performed a miracle, the lid would be off. There would be no more disguising who Jesus was. People would talk. The word would spread. Jesus performs miracles. Now, I love Mary's response. Look at verse 5. His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." It's like she's not even listening to her son. She just turned to the servants and said, "Do whatever he tells you." She knew Jesus could help. She knew that Jesus was very special. When did that start? I'm guessing with the virgin birth. She knew Jesus could do something with this problem. So look at verse 6. Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." So they did so. The home where the wedding was being held had six big stone jars that held between 90 and 135 liters of water. These were big jars. Now, why were they there at that home for the wedding? Because they were used for ceremonial washing. Ritual hand washing preceded the meal. And what would happen is before a meal, the servants would draw water from these jars and come and pour it over each guest's hands so they had clean hands. And Jesus told the servants to take the six stone jars and refill them to the brim. And so if you're into math, that's 545 to 813 liters of water total. And then he said in verse 8, draw some out and take to the master of the banquet. Who is the master of the banquet? He was kind of like the master of ceremonies. He was responsible for managing the celebration. Bottom line, it was his job to make sure the party was great. And then notice verse 9. The master of the banquet tasted the water that he had turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. The master of the banquet didn't know where the wine came from. But what's interesting is this: the servants knew. They knew. People who were working the party were witnesses to Jesus' first miracle. Isn't that awesome? You see what Jesus was doing there? He was having the servants, the lowly, be witness to his first miracle. He was putting them in a place of honor. And if you remember the story of the resurrection, which we celebrated a couple of weeks ago, who were the first witnesses to the resurrection? Women. Women were not held in a place of honor in Jesus' culture, and yet here were these women being given the greatest honor of all time to be the first witnesses of the resurrection. You see, that's my Jesus. He's always taking people that are low and giving them places of honor. That's what he did here. And do you notice what else is going on? Jesus just made 545 to 818 liters of wine. That's a lot of wine. And it wasn't the boxed variety. This is good stuff. The master of the banquet, he took the cup, he swirled it around, and he sniffed it, and then he sipped. And swallowed. And at that moment, I'm sure he had a startled look on his face, and he went, "Screaming Eagle Cabernet 40 BC, that's amazing. This was good wine." And then he said this to the groom. Notice verse 10. "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you save the best till now." I mean, obviously the normal time to bring out the best wine to be served would be at the beginning of the party, when everyone could appreciate it, not later when they're too drunk to care. But the best wine was saved for last. Do you notice what Jesus did here? He took a potentially disastrous situation for the groom and his family, one in which they would experience incredible shame, and he transformed it to something of honor. from no wine to wine, from shame to honor. And then our story concludes in verse 11 where it says this: what Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. This was not merely a miracle, it was a sign. And signs are miracles that have a meaning. And in verse 11, we see there's two meanings to this miracle. First, it revealed Jesus' glory. It showed that he was more than just your average rabbi. Second, it inspired his disciples' faith. Their faith was strengthened. That's what miracles often do. It's an incredible story. And it shows us a number of things about Jesus. And I just want to bring four thoughts about Jesus out of this story. Four thoughts about Jesus. Here's number one. Jesus likes parties. Jesus likes parties. As you read the Gospels, it's clear. Jesus did not shy away from a good party. In fact, because of his party behavior, he was accused of being a glutton and a drunkard and a friend of all the wrong kinds of people. Now, I think Jesus liked parties because he knew that parties were a great way for people to share their lives with others. So I want you to think about something this morning. When you appropriately participate in a party, you are being like Jesus. Have you ever thought about that? When you appropriately participate in a party, you are being like Jesus. I think Christ followers should throw some of the best parties out there. When we appropriately participate in a party, we're being like Jesus. Here's my second thought. Jesus produces the miracle. I was thinking about those six jars, and I wonder if there's any significance to the fact there were six. Six, the number in the Bible, is the number of man. It's the number of incompletion. Six symbolizes what people can do. And people can do a lot, right? We can put people in space. I mean, think about what we've done with technology over the last 20 years. People can do a lot. But people can only do so much. The servants could fill the jars, but they couldn't pull off the miracle. They needed Jesus to pull off the miracle. The servants could fill the jars, but only Jesus could turn the water into wine. The servants did what they could do, and then they needed to allow Jesus to do what only he could do. And that's a good way for us to live. We should do everything we can do, and then let Jesus do what he can do. He's the miracle worker, not us. And when we do what we can do, when we fill our jars, when we do what we can do to deal with the issues in our marriage, to deal with our addiction, to raise children who will follow Jesus, to deal with our anxieties and our stresses, when we do what we can do, and then we ask Jesus to do what only he can do, watch out, because amazing things are going to happen. When you put human effort with divine activity, watch out. Great things are going to happen. Here's the third thing. Jesus brings joy. In the Old Testament, wine is associated with gladness. The psalmist tells us, wine gladdens the human heart. The ancient rabbis had a saying, it went like this: when the wine runs out, the party is over, the joy is gone. But if you think about Jesus' first miracle, it shows us that he is the source of real joy and gladness. Don't drink cheap wine to find lasting joy. Too many people today are trying to find lasting joy in their careers, in their relationships, from their iPad screen, from their stuff, from their money. All of those things are cheap wine. They won't bring lasting joy. Can I encourage you to drink the best wine to find joy? Jesus is the best wine. He is the ultimate source of lasting joy. It says in John 15:11, listen to this. Jesus is speaking here. He says, I have told you this so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. My joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. Jesus wants to give us his joy. And so will you open yourself up and allow him to fill you with his joy? And here's my fourth thought. Jesus removes shame. As you go through the Gospels, you'll see over and over that Jesus was always undercutting his culture's honor-shame code by loving and accepting and hanging out with the shamed. In the Gospels, Jesus was constantly moving people from a place of shame to a place of honor. We just saw him do that with the groom. No wine to wine, shame to honor. And Jesus wants to do the same thing in your life. If you are living from a place of shame, Jesus wants to restore you to a place of dignity and honor. As Jesus hung on the cross, he was shamed, he was mocked, he was scorned, he was rejected. And on the cross, not only did Jesus experience shame, he also bore our shame and sin so we could be forgiven, set free, and be given a place of honor. When you decide to follow Jesus, when you acknowledge that he is your Savior and King, when you give your allegiance to him, not only are you forgiven, and not only is your relationship with God restored, but you are also given a new identity. The Bible says when you acknowledge that Jesus is your Savior and Lord, and when you decide to follow him, God adopts you into his family as an honored child. You are now a son and daughter of the Most High God. You're no longer a sinner. You're now a redeemed saint. You've been given a place of honor, and you can now live from that place of honor. You know what that means? That means you can stop telling yourself that you're worthless, that you're awful, that you're hated by God. You can stop telling yourself that you always have to live in bondage to whatever you're living in bondage to. You can stop telling yourself that you're a sinner. You can stop living from a place of shame. When you come to Christ, you are given a new identity in Jesus. You are now a redeemed saint. You are now an honored child, and you can now live from that place of honor. I believe today Jesus wants to do a work in your life. He wants to forgive you. He wants to set you free. He wants to enable you to see yourself as he sees you. And then he wants you to live from that reality. Jesus wants to move you to a place of honor. Will you come to him? Will you let him do a work in your life? Kim and the team are going to come and get set up, and we're going to close by singing a song called Waymaker. And it talks about Jesus being the waymaker, the promise keeper, the miracle worker. And as we sing that song, or maybe you're going to listen, maybe you don't want to sing, you're just going to listen, or maybe you are going to sing online. But as you hear those words, waymaker, promise keeper, miracle worker, I want you to open yourself up to what Jesus can do in your life. Maybe you need him to be your waymaker today. Maybe you need Jesus to show you the way from shame to honor. Maybe you need to show, he needs to show you the way so you can understand who you really are. Maybe he needs to open your eyes if you're a follower of his, so that you see that you really are an honored child, a redeemed saint. Maybe you need Jesus to be your way maker today. Maybe you need him to be your promise keeper. He promised to pour his joy into our lives. Maybe you need to open yourself up and let him do that for you today. And Jesus also says he's a miracle worker. We saw that today, turn water into wine. And maybe you've been doing what you can do, and maybe now's the time you need to turn a situation over to Jesus and let him work a miracle.